Earl Ingram Show. Weekday mornings from 8 till 10 on The Shaw. 540 AM and 101.1 FM WAU.
Too much. Who keeps leaving me up to my own devices on this network? Hey, welcome to the Maggie Dawn Show. This is not Maggie Dawn. Rather, this is her producer, Anya, coming to you twice in 1 week, double action, because we're usually not live on Fridays, but I'm always alive on Fridays, all the Fridays I've been alive for so far, at least. So why not share them with you? We're going to depart from the topics you've heard today. How do I know they're topics you've heard today? Because they're topics I've heard today. Because I have been producing all day, listening to many, many thoughts on the speaker race and things of this nature, things that are sad and a little boring and a lot depressing at times. So welcome to the Friday edition. We are departing from all of that noise, all of the news into just things I want to talk about. I hope you like it. So let's start with the song you just heard. It was a cover of Antihero, originally by Taylor Swift. That cover is by Chase Petra. I don't know, something about the punk roots of that song. I just like them better than Taylor's iteration. I love the lyrics, but the way Chase plays with it, it just hits close to home for me. And I want to start today, if we're going to talk about Halloween coming up and things that bring me joy, what better topic is there than Taylor Swift? Taylor's been in the news a lot for the past forever, but especially this past year, she embarked on, I can't imagine you haven't heard about this, but if you haven't, Taylor Swift is a female musician. She started in country, she moved to pop, and now she's just absolutely genre-defying, and her latest tour is an homage to all the different eras, essentially, that her life has gone through, that country era, that pop era, her, all these different things. And it's called the Eras Tour, and it is an absolutely record-breaking tour. Some statistics, I realize I pulled them up on my phone and not on my laptop. What were you thinking, producer Anya? How dare you? Well, now I don't have them, but her tour has broken records. I'm trying to find the estimations here. Hold on. It's okay to have a little dead air as a treat, right? Yes. 22 billion with a B has already been generated in ticket sales for North America on Taylor Swift's Eras tour. All right. She's made 100 million in global pre-sales. 146 dates were announced. This is obviously from the start of the tour. And the Eras Tour concert film, which is what we're going to get into in a little bit here, is being shown in 8,500 theaters in more than 100 countries. Folks, the power of T-Swift is undeniable. I do not have to come here today and teach you that. What I'd like to comment on, though, is something interesting. If you're not familiar with Taylor, a theme that the media has sort of ascribed to her life is her various relationships she's had. Many of her songs are about the relationship, about the breakup, about information she gleaned during the relationship, looking back on being young and dating someone older and then becoming that age and realizing like, oh my gosh, I was a kid and he was an adult. This was strange. And let's talk about that through music. Taylor has always been breaking boundaries with these kinds of things ever since she's been able to become more independent, ever since her label and her music was put under her own name instead of under producers and men who wanted to own her, even though her entire music is about not being owned. There's a new chapter to this story, to the story of Taylor and the various background men that so many in the media ascribe to be her muses and such, which is that she's dating some football guy. And that is what I call him. I know his name. I know his team, but to make a point here, she's dating some football guy. And it boggles my mind to be scrolling through Facebook. It's one of my least favorite activities, but it happens to the best of us, to be scrolling through Facebook and get some suggested page that's like, hey, we think you might like sports. And I'm like, well, that's why I don't have to worry about the algorithm stealing my identity. You clearly don't know me. But it'll suggest some stupid meme that's like, oh, Taylor's dating Travis Kelce of the Kansas City Chiefs to promote herself. She's riding Travis's coattails. She's standing in the football stadium looking all purdy in her jersey. And that is all of that is so that she can earn some more fame and fortune off of, I'm going to say it again, Travis Kelce of the Kansas City Chiefs. Are you kidding me? Are you absolutely kidding me that there are people who can look at what this woman has done already in her life and go, you know what she needs to really break through to the mainstream and be an autonomous artist? A guy from the Kansas City Chiefs of all teams. Breaks my heart to see it happen. But I want to uplift some female voices today alongside Taylor. I think it's amazing that her concert is selling out. Folks, if you want to talk about moving the American economy, what's better for that than a concert? I'm sure, you know, if I really got into the math and science, as they call it, of economics, there's something that probably is better. But in my mind, I recently traveled across the country in part because of a concert, not entirely. But I flew to Houston with my partner to see, who do you think it is? Before I say it, just think to yourself, who would producer Anya brave Texas of all places to see? Did you say Peter Gabriel? If you did, first of all, get out of my head. You wouldn't know that unless you were a psychic. And also, yeah, that's the correct answer. We flew to Houston to see this concert. We bought tickets in Houston, a hotel room in Houston, food in Houston, Ubers in Houston. That's great for Houston. It's also great for any city in Wisconsin where someone comes, performs a concert that is unique and different or otherwise inaccessible somewhere else. When they come to Wisconsin, what happens, right? They get a hotel room. They get some food. They probably buy some merch. Some of that tax money goes into our local economies. I think that's amazing and ever so demoralizing that she's met with this assumption that, no, Miss Swift, even though you've sold out these huge arenas on an insane number of nights at an insane price point, and now that wasn't enough, now a film, a concert film, is out as of this weekend. You can see it all across Wisconsin and all across the world, as I just read to you, in 100-some countries, 8,500 theaters. What economic force is better in this moment than Taylor Swift? So the idea that somehow, oh, she's got the jersey, she's got the look, she's got the boyfriend, and that's what we think is selling tickets? Come on. Come on, say it with your chest. You either don't think women's achievements matter or are as big as men's. There we go. That's the sentence I wanted to say. Or you just don't know what she's done. Anyways, back to lifting up some female voices. Local film person, programmer, there it is, a local film programmer for the Milwaukee Film Fest, Abby Esterline, who I had the great privilege of actually going to film school with. We graduated together. We shook Willem Dafoe's hand at our graduation, one right after the other, a couple of girls with the initials AE just making our way through film school. Her, first of all, she's a huge Swiftie, absolutely adores Taylor and her music. I know most of what I know about Taylor through Abby. And her article, her contributions to the film scene here in Milwaukee regarding this upcoming film were so moving to so many people that this article about her went all the way from here in Milwaukee to the New York Times. And it's just so exciting to see other young women, women from this area, women who are uplifting other women's voices, Abby with Taylor, and hopefully me too now with uplifting Abby and Taylor's voices. It just brings so much joy to my heart. The article, so that you can look it up, is still available, I believe, through the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, as well as the New York Times, and it is called A Name That I Should Have Written Down. Ah, yes, as movie theaters embrace Swift, one showcases her exes. There we go. That is Abby's article. I hope you look into it, and I hope maybe we can take some time over this weekend as we go into Halloween weekend. I anticipate you will see many outfits based on Taylor's many eras. If you need some last-minute inspiration for something that will be culturally relevant to all the young people in your life, go ahead and check out her music video for Bad Blood or Google Eras Tour Costumes. There's truly a unique outfit for each of these albums, if not each of these songs. And I anticipate you're going to see a lot of women, a lot of people in general walking around this weekend dressed up in some reference to Taylor, her music, this film, the incredible momentum that she as a singular person, almost as a brand, has had across music. I think it's also important to note in Taylor's music and about uplifting female voices that Taylor has had to, in the past several years, actually go back and re-record all of her music. Now, I'm not studied enough in Swiftology to explain to you the intricacies of why her original records were somehow out of her hands and in the hands of someone who did not want to give her autonomy over her own songs. I don't know the names and dates and stuff, but what I can tell you is that she's gone back to her very first record, her very first album, which I think is just called Taylor Swift, and is re-recording in studio with people on those tracks to re-release all of her songs. Now, with at the end of each title, if it's one she's re-recorded, you will see the phrase Taylor's version. And something about that speaks to me. The idea of, you know, she worked so hard to create this art. She worked so hard, largely, frankly, on her own. And is such, I know people throw the word genius around a lot, but frankly, they don't throw it around enough for women. So here's this. I think she's a genius. And for her to have to go back and redo that work, to be Sisyphus with the rock, you've already been up the mountain. You must return to the bottom with all of your records, all of your work, in order to return it to your own name. It should have never been taken away from her in the first place. It's just such an incredible effort. A song that I think really resonates with this topic is her own song, This Is the Man by Taylor Swift.
I would be complex. I would be cool. They'd say I played the field before I found someone to commit to. And that would be okay for me to do.
WAUK.
Looking out a dirty old window. Down below the cars in the city go rushing by. I sit here alone and I wonder why.
Some of us certainly are the kids in America, and that's what I want to talk about today on the Maggie Dawn Show. Hey, welcome back. This is producer Anya. If you want to contribute to the show today, you can do so by text through our app. That's an excellent way. You can also call us at 844-967-2789. Now note, I am the producer and the host today. So if you call in, you're going to notice no one's going to be able to screen your call until break. That's because I got to talk to everybody until break, and then I'm going to talk to you one-on-one real quick before I let you on the air. So, that's what's up today. Anyways, you just heard the song Kids in America by Kim Wilde. I remember that song very nostalgically from my childhood as being one of the pop-punk beats, there's the three words I wanted together, of the Jimmy Neutron film. Anybody else my age remember that movie? That, I think, was some great cinema. Going to the text line for a second, I see a familiar name here in the text line. A certain Aaron Zahmer says that he thinks he saw that article at New York Times. That's so cool. you are now 1 degree away from the esteemed Abby Esterline of Taylor Swift, New York Times fame. And additionally, Aaron writes, Taylor is the modern day Beatles. That is right. I would levy this. I think Taylor could do Imagine. I don't know if John Lennon could do All Too Well, the 10-minute version. I'll just say that. If you disagree with me, call in. Anyways, got a blast onto the next topic. I want to talk to you about something I did while I was in Houston. And no, it's not just me bragging about my vacation. I'll tell you, it wasn't entirely a vacation. After that Peter Gabriel concert, after walking about a mile from the Toyota Center to our hotel, we got there and all the elevators had broken as we walked 11 stories up at midnight in the Texan heat of October. So don't think that I went to Texas and just put my cowgirl boots up and, you know, was a lazy ranch hand for a couple days. I had to work too. One of those things I did was we went to the Houston Space Center, the Johnson Space Center. And I want to talk to you about something I observed there. I observed a lot of incredible artifacts, a lot of things that reminded me that I never, ever, ever want to get launched into space. Things like how small the capsules were that everyone who's ever gone to space has been in. I'm too claustrophobic. Things about how flammable everything is. I'm too fire-phobic, whatever that word would be. Flammophobic, perhaps. I don't want to go to space. But I observed something that warmed my heart, which was, first of all, presentation on the Artemis program, the sister, twin sister program to the Apollo missions of fame of the 60s and 70s that took us all the way to the moon and back. We're going to try to go to the moon again really soon. I don't know if you know this. And this time we're using the appropriate Greek goddess for it. That would be Artemis, who's, of course, the goddess of the moon, not her brother Apollo, who's in charge of the sun. We didn't shoot any astronauts into the sun yet. We'll see what SpaceX thinks maybe next spring. Let's see how things are then. But on top of observing the description of this program, how we're going to go back to the moon and we have something to look forward to and something as a nation that seems sort of apolitical almost, science-oriented, science-rooted almost, I observed so many kids at this science center. It was a great center for kids, I want to say, as a former educator. So much was hands-on. So much was accessible to them. Things were in plain language for a lot of it. And I saw so many kids there really absorbing that info and absorbing that their government, or if they were from outside of the U.S., at least that the U.S. government and affiliated governments throughout the world, perhaps one that represents where they're from, are going to work together. And we're going to peacefully work together to put some people on the moon. And this time, one of those people's even going to be a woman. And another person is going to be a person of color. And that's because, and this occurred to me in the NASA Space Center for the first time in my life, oh my gosh, we've only sent white men to the moon. Why have we only sent white men to the moon? How is that possible? It's something like only 16 human beings, maybe 13, one of those two numbers. Only 16-some human beings have ever put their feet on the moon, and you're telling me every single one of them was a white guy? Yeah, we've had spacewalks done by people of various backgrounds. Good, good, good. That's great. We've had manned missions into space and the ISS and these things. But to look around what was frankly a really, really diverse background of kids and their families, and they're playing with robots, and they're coding things, and they're getting excited about a world where this kind of science that is for, what's the word I want? Not for militaristic, opportunistic things. I know we're concentrated on space because we can put something in space for better or for worse against our enemies or friends. I get that. I know. Something that was really radicalizing for me when I decided to go to art school was a tweet that said, look, ceramicists would make $100,000 out of college if drones were made out of clay. Right? If it helps the military out, yeah. Of course, it's got good paying jobs. Yeah, of course, it gets more funding because of the implications, you know? But at least in that moment, I was watching kids look up at the stars, and I got the sense from their smiles and their excitedness and the way they just ran from each activity to each activity, never bored of the science they were learning, which oh my gosh, is that not the way that we should be doing it, right? You know, not to get too Montessori whatever on the air, but these kids loved science. I wonder if they love science every day in their science classroom. I wonder if they have a designated science classroom wherever it is they go to school outside of going to the Johnson Space Center that day. But to see them look up at the sky and hear the words, the sky's the limit, and I could just kind of tell they were all going, no, it's not. There's more beyond the sky. And we as a country, as a nation, as a world through the Artemis Accords, which I'm going to talk about next, we are going to go together, perhaps boldly, and perhaps where no one has gone before, perhaps boldly where no one like them. Each girl who was there, each child of color who was there, each, you know, we don't know everything about the personal lives of every astronaut, right? But unless I misremember, I don't think we've had an openly LGBT person go to the moon, right? I don't know about those. I don't know about that. But it's amazing to think that this generation of kids, at least the small percentage that I saw that day, they might get to grow up in a world where that statement we all heard, you can be anything you want. You just got to put your mind to it. This might be the generation where that gets actualized. And that is really, really cool. That is why, at least going into this weekend, I'm a little bit less worried about the kids in America. Taking you to the break is that very song, Kids in America by Kim Wilde.
And the Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM, WAUK.
What happened was, we reached the moon, but lost in space, I think we got there all too soon. But you know what?
What?
I'm coming back for you, baby.
For me, Carly?
I'm coming back for you.
Oh, thanks. I hope you're coming back, not next Friday, but the Friday after, the next time that I'll be live hosting. This is producer Anya, forgot my own name for a second, and the show is called The Maggie Dawn Show. Usually you've got Maggie Dawn on the show, but instead today it's me, Anya. Hi. The song you just heard is Carly Rae Jepsen, The Loneliest Time, featuring Rufus Wainwright. You might be familiar with his work. He has a very popular cover of Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah. I believe it's Rufus's version that was used in Shrek, if you've ever heard that. And Carly Rae Jepsen, if you don't recognize the name, is very famous for her 2013 hit. Is that the right year? I think so. 2013 hit, Call Me Maybe. Don't maybe call me for sure. Like my friend here, Mark from the SAC, is doing. Mark, you told me you have some info pertaining to the Artemis program, or at least names for moons, I think is what you said.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because the name of Selene is actually the name of the protagonist in the Underworld series.
Mm.
But Homer actually wrote his series of hymns. And one of the lines from one of his hymns, and based on Selene, is, "Hail, white-armed goddess, bright Selene, mild, bright-pressed queen." And it's a lovely little poem. I mean, that I had not been aware of it until I was looking it up tonight, hearing this. But I mean, it's just, it's just interesting. I'm glad now that they're calling it, because the moon has been feminine in mythology, and it's kind of nice that they're finally recognizing that in science.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. There are far too many women, far too many, whether they were mythological, like Artemis, or very much real, too many women whose achievements have been marked up to that or their husbands, that of their husbands. I remember seeing a picture of Marie Curie where she's listed as her husband's assistant. Yeah, right. All right, come on. Put some respect on her name. other women, not in the science sector, perhaps, but I remember too seeing a photo of Frida Kahlo listed. I can't think of her husband's name, but it basically said, artist's wife sometimes dabbles in paint too. How quaint that this little woman do such a thing. So yeah, I'm really glad that this program is giving the appropriate name, because Apollo's all about the sun and he's a dude. That's his whole thing. If we were ever going to go to the moon and name it after something Greek, should have been Artemis the whole time, or some other more appropriate name. Continuing on this topic, I think Mark bringing up the poem and that imagery is really strong for what I'm about to talk about. One of the places you can visit when you go to the Johnson Space Center, they do a bunch of different tram tours. You see, you're on the NASA grounds, and it's really far apart to get to everything. And of course, they don't want lay people just wandering around a place that is essentially Site 52. Who knows what aliens and such could lurk behind different doors. So you get on these tram tours. One you can do is the astronaut training facility. Unfortunately, we went on a Sunday. I guess astronauts get Sundays off, which is kind of funny. So no one was training in the facility, but we got to walk sort of the boss walks up above and look down upon all the different places. We saw some very interesting things. The NASA sewing room is about as organized as you would expect it to be. I'm taking that one personal to my heart. If you're a crafter at home and you think, oh my goodness, I bet the NASA sewing room where they sew literal spacesuits is very organized, pristine, all put together. Let me assure you, it looks exactly like your sewing room and mine as well. So don't be too hard on yourself. Even the government-funded seamstresses are also just kind of throwing their needles and scissors wherever they want, I guess. But on the far wall of this training facility, and I should say this is a huge hangar, the cranes that they had in there said, upper limit, 20.5 tons. This crane can only lift 20-some tons. That's how huge this area was. There was a one-to-one scale replica of the International Space Station, so they can practice what those halls will look like, where things are from where, and that only takes up about a third of it. So this is a huge, huge room. So think of how tall the walls would be. And again, it's set up like a airplane hangar, but with a walkway up high for tourists. It was built with that in mind. And up on this wall, on the right-hand side, are two equally huge badges that took me a moment to recognize. Every space flight since the early days, they get a patch that represents their space flight. You've probably seen the Apollo 13 one. It's the moon's surface with an eagle, and that eagle has a branch in its talons. This is because of the language used to refer to the machinery as the eagle and where it's going and where it's landing and such. But these two patches stuck out to me. They weren't, you know, silly like some of the other patches had been. One that I saw for a space flight literally had a covered wagon that said 8 days or bust. Maybe not great language to be using, but hey, it's the astronauts themselves who made it. So if anyone's allowed to have dark humor, it's them. But these two badges were really no funny business, very real. And the tour guide pointed out to us, for those like me who didn't recognize them right away, that those two badges are the spaceflight badges of the Challenger and the Columbia, which, if you're not familiar, and let's be real, don't say who's not familiar with the Challenger and the Columbia. Unfortunately, a lot of people. So I just like to let's just do some non-judgmental education. Those are two spacecrafts that were built by NASA that, as they were sending them up into space, catastrophically broke apart, and all lives on board were lost in both instances. So with that in mind, now contend with this idea, right? What have I just told you? That this huge, huge room where every astronaut ever for the past, I don't remember when they said this building was built, but at least since when the Challenger happened, that first badge went up, and then later when the Columbia happened, a second badge went up, and it's a big wall. There is space, right? Hopefully it's never space that's needed, but it's there. It's quite jarring for me to realize that looming above in what must have been 50-foot by 50-foot design were the quintessential logos of two of the worst things that ever happened to the NASA space program, two total losses of life on a space flight. And I think a lot of people, perhaps if they were managers of NASA, maybe you were some sort of manager of the astronaut training facility, maybe you would levy some concerns. Hey, every day for years and years and years building up to this space flight, these astronauts and their helpers, their families, the people who sew things and tape things together, weld things together, everyone involved in this endeavor, they come into this room. And they see they're gonna see these two huge badges. I can imagine a type of person who goes, look, that's gonna throw people off their game. That's a lot, that's a heavy topic to put a big picture of in a room where people need to be focused and alert and attentive. But after reflecting on it, I actually think there's some incredible leadership being shown. Now, I don't know whose decision it was. Maybe it was an individual's decision, maybe it was by committee. I don't know who chose and had the authority to say, go put the two badges up there, or how soon it happened after the Challenger. But I think there's something to be said about the type of leadership mindset happening, maybe at least in that room at that government facility, that says, look, there is nothing more important than the preservation of lives as they pursue these scientific efforts. Nothing. Not money, not ego, not any kind of nonsense that exists here on the surface of the earth. We are looking to go beyond that. That's what it felt like this was saying. And it felt like it was saying, perhaps, every day when that astronaut, that seamstress, that engineer, that robotics person, whoever, walked onto that floor, whether they had had a good day, whether they had had a bad day, somewhere in between, maybe they were tired, maybe they were anxious, to provide something to look at, not provide, that's not the word, to not enforce either, to approve of the thought that we must turn our eyes at least once a day, perhaps, to the last time fatal mistakes were made. And yeah, I think that would throw a lot of people off their game. I don't want to be reminded of all of my mistakes every time I come to work, right? Who would? But perhaps there is something meaningful. There is something useful. There is something, while morbid, invigorating, life-affirming, in fact, about having imagery. And now again, when I say imagery, it's not pictures from the disaster. It's not the shuttle breaking apart or anything like that. Again, it's just the badges, and the badges show like the ship and the last names of the crew. And I think the Earth is in the background of one. They're just very simple but astute logos of the spaceflight. And they hang there day and night, even on the Sunday that we went when no one was working, to remind all of us that in the pursuit of such lofty goals, to go to the moon and do the other things, you know, people's lives are at risk. I wonder how differently many other governmental organizations, perhaps like, I can't even think of a good one right now, but maybe the Senate and the House, maybe the Oval Office, maybe these different places where individuals of these government organizations or whatever, if perhaps they too had to place on their walls the badges of their failures and once a day turn their eyes to them and say, are we gonna do that again? And don't get me wrong, let me be clear about what I know and what I don't know, right? I know Wall Street isn't like a government organization, but imagine too if a place like the trading floor of Wall Street perhaps had to have some sort of badge representing, I don't know, the great stock collapse in that preceded the Great Depression, Black Monday, the 2008 crisis. There is a type of integrity that I saw at least performed through the display of ethics at NASA that said to me, failure is not an option. In fact, I bought a mug from them. I felt it was a very good phrase for me as a producer. I bought a mug from them that even says, failure is not an option. And I wonder, gosh, I'm so heated about the Senate stuff still this week. I wonder if we had a government, a set of elected officials, a set of, frankly, anybody in power anywhere, if it was the Supreme Court, if it was anywhere, for whom the phrase failure is not an option meant as much to them as it does clearly to the folks working at NASA at that particular outpost. I wonder how much quicker we would finish this, we finished the speaker race, but how much more quickly we would end this whole debacle regarding the imminent closure of the U.S. government, a time where if that time should pass without resolution, right, if you listen to Matt Flynn these past few days, as I have as his producer, we are going to enter a period of time where those who work for our military are not going to get paid. Many of them are single income earners. Many of them have kids. Outside of that, let's talk our park rangers, anyone who works for the government. Yes, our military, that's very important. But additionally, in addition to that, we're coming up against a time frame where the elected officials will go home to their salaries and their heated homes and such. And our park rangers might not even get paid. Our military won't even get paid. How much quicker would we have that solved if perhaps they too had to adhere to this idea that failure, guess what? It's just simply not an option. That's all I got for this bit. Please enjoy the remainder of, I just love this song so much. The Loneliest Time. It sounds so sad, but it's so happy. By Carly Rae Jepsen and the incredible Rufus Wainwright.
What happened was, we reached the moon, but lost in space, I think we got there all too soon.
Brought to you by Opportunity at Work and the Ad Council.
The Shaw, WAUK.
I've posed for pictures with ivory soap. I've petted stray dogs and shied clear of dope. My smile is brilliant. My glance is tender. But I'm noted most for my unspoiled gender.
Your wife?
I've been made Miss Rheingold, though I never touch beer. And I'm the person to whom they say, "You're sweet, my dear." The only etchings I've seen have been behind glass. And the closest I've been to a bar was at ballet class, prim and proper.
That is the indomitable voice of Eartha Kitt and her fantastic song, great for this Halloween season, I Want to Be Evil, by Eartha Kitt. Love that song so much. Love Eartha so much. I think it's so interesting that so many folks my age and folks of all ages only know her for The Emperor's New Groove. Her role is the villainous, what is her name? Yzma, there it is. But you should check out her other work, her music, her modeling, her other films. They're all really, really, really good. Speaking of that, if you don't know me already, my name's Anya. I'm usually the producer for Maggie. We're starting this little thing where every other Friday, I jump in and I host. I talk about things, that other hosts perhaps don't, because I'm not a lawyer, I'm not an accountant, just a film major who wandered into a radio studio one day and they decided to keep me around. But I want to give, as we go into Halloween weekend, some film recommendations. Some of them are spooky in the Halloween sense. Some of them are scary in the real world sense. And some of them are just good fun. So, of course, I mentioned at the top of the show the Taylor Swift concert film that is playing in 8,500 theaters in 100 countries, including right here in Wisconsin. I know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that the fantastic Oriental Theater in downtown Milwaukee has a couple showings of that. I know it because of their amazing film programmer, Abby Esterline, a dear friend of mine who I went to school with, film school with. She has been taking the helm of getting that concert film there, theming things. If you go, you will not be disappointed. Going to the Oriental to see something is a theatrical experience like no other. So go see that this weekend if you're looking for something fun. Also in theaters this weekend, a little less fun, but it should be spoken on, is Martin Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon. Now, I want to be real. Haven't read the book yet. Haven't really seen enough Scorsese films yet, if I'm being real. But I want to highlight maybe an opinion you're not going to hear in the media, which is I'm hearing very, very good reviews of Killers of a Flower Moon on a technical, cinematic sense, and in large part on a ethical sense, on a historical accuracy sense. But I think it's important to remember as a film-going audience that we do still need to make more films about Indigenous folks, about Native Americans, and other groups like this that are not just about those groups being murdered. In case maybe it's a far too distant memory, I'd like to remind folks that there was a period in period of time in cinema history, maybe when some of you were even growing up and seeing some of your first films in your life, where the murder of Indigenous folks on screen wasn't something treated with somber reverence or even with sadness. It was kind of a bit. Go back to some of those old John Wayne films, not to lay blame on John Wayne. Listen. Don't shoot the messenger, okay? But let's be real. There were a lot of films about cowboys and I don't like using this word, but it's what the genre was called, cowboys and Indians, right? Where the goal of the film was the hero would kill all the Indians. And that's really, really traumatizing when the only time you see yourself, and I'm not Indigenous, I'm not speaking for indigeneity, but I'm speaking for representation, that if the only time you see yourself on screen, you're getting killed, it's quite demoralizing. Now, Killers of a Flower Moon goes a different way. It's about a group who they struck oil. And then in order for someone to steal the money from them, people started being murdered, right? But of course, it is still, at the end of the day, a film where Indigenous people are getting killed in kind of, from what I'm hearing, gory, somewhat bloody ways. And people kind of want to throw the, but it's a Scorsese film, you know, he made this and he made that and it's really good. How, what were you expecting back in people's faces? And look, I get it. I wasn't expecting Martin Scorsese to make a Ken Burns documentary, all right? Leave unto Ken Burns what is Ken Burns and leave unto Scorsese that which is Caesar's, right? Okay, I get that. But let's not speak over folks when they're saying, hi, we still want a couple movies where, I don't know, we go the whole time without getting killed. Let's still make sure those films get made. Couple other films. If you heard my show on Wednesday, I talked about Israel and evangelicals and things. And I wanted to recommend some films, completely forgot because I totally just ran through the end of that show. Some films that may help, if that's a topic you're interested in, fantastic documentary called Kings of Capitol Hill about some of the funding that's happening for that, if that's something you're passionate about, as well as Till Kingdom Come, which is more specifically about those evangelical communities I talked about and their connection to Israel on a prophetic level. If you want a film that really gets in depth with people who often don't open up about their spiritual leanings, such as Appalachian and rural Southern evangelicals, it's a very, very interesting documentary. That's one of those scary in the real world sense films. Also scary in a real world sense, but good to watch. This is easier to find. It should be on YouTube. A short film, short video called Whispers from Gaza. This is a series of interviews that were put to animation, made under threat of murder in Gaza, where a journalist went in and asked Gazans their true opinions about Hamas and about these things that they are not able to speak out loud in their communities without, again, those same individuals like Hamas who wish to appear as being a totalitarian, or they are totalitarian. They want to appear as though everyone there agrees with them, right? Oh, I should take a breath at some point on the air. It's a film about how there are many, many Gazans who want peace, who do not agree with Hamas, who are in fear of Hamas killing them. It's just important to remember that in all of these conflicts, everyone is an individual. I'm going to say that again. Everyone is an individual. And the idea that any group can be summarized as saying, oh, they all want blank, is just never a good thing to get into, in my opinion. Outside of that, here are some horror films I recommend as a film major who spent way too much time watching them instead of hanging out in college. Check out if you like found footage, which is the style of the Blair Witch Project, meaning it looks like it was shot on an old video recorder. The Taking of Deborah Logan is a phenomenal take on that. Anything Jordan Peele, his films Get Out, Us, and Nope. Oh, really, really good films. You should check them out. Cam is fantastic, and it's on Netflix. It's about a cam girl who her doppelganger shows up online and maybe is living in her same home. It's sexy, it's scary, it's a good date night, and it's on Netflix. And if you want to watch some things